Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you are in the know. You can find much more information about the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Charles Geschke, the co-founder and chairman of Adobe Systems and a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will serve as your moderator for this evening's program. This particular program is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Science and Technology Forum. And it's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Bill Davidow, a friend of mine, and a former Intel Corporation Senior Vice President and author of the new book, Overconnected, The Promise and Threat of the Internet. Bill has been a high technology industry executive and a venture investor for more than 30 years. And he continues to act as an active advisor to Moore Davidow Ventures, a venture capital firm that he founded. Davidow is also the author of two other books, Marketing High Technology, and a co-author of Total Customer Service and the Virtual Corporation. While at Intel, Bill served as a senior vice president of marketing and sales, as well as vice president of the microcomputer systems division. Prior to Intel, Bill worked in various managerial positions at Hewlett-Packard and General Electric. Bill's community involvement extends to serving on the boards of the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, and Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. He also sits on the foundation board of the University of California, San Francisco, and on the board of the California Nature Conservancy. Bill earned his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering at Dartmouth College, along with a master's degree in electrical engineering from both Dartmouth and the California Institute of Technology. And he completed his education with a doctorate in electrical engineering from Stanford University. I'd like to ask you now to please welcome Bill Davidow.
Thank you, Chuck. On May 6th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average precipitously declined by 1,000 points. 550 points of that decline occurred in approximately 5 minutes. The flash crash, as we have come to know, was followed rather quickly by a rocket recovery where two-thirds of the value was regained that day. And the question I'd like you to think about when I take you through all these events is whether things like the flash crash are outliers or whether they're just ordinary bad days at the office in an internet-driven, over-connected world. I'm going to explain to you why I believe things like the flash crash, the crash of 2008, the unwinding of the Icelandic economy, the loss of your privacy, and things like WikiLeaks are just bad days at the office. And the message I'd like to leave you with is that we are going to have to learn how to better manage the internet. I'm going to do this by giving you a perspective on interconnections. And then I'm going to explain to you what overconnectivity is, and then I'm going to give you a few examples, and then spend a few words on telling you the types of things that I think we should consider doing about the situation. So I'd like to take you back in history all the way to 2007 in Stanford University. And I was attending a seminar at Stanford University, and it was a great talk given by Buzz McCoy, who was the former manager of real estate for Morgan Stanley. And Buzz was explaining and blaming everybody you could think of. He was blaming the naive consumer. He was blaming the real estate brokers. He was blaming the mortgage brokers and the people who did that. He blamed the investment bank. He blamed the bankers. He blamed the real bankers, and he blamed the regulators and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And at the end of his talk, I couldn't restrain myself, and I said, Buzz, you blamed everybody. Why didn't you blame the internet? the room went absolutely quiet. And then everybody broke out in laughter, and I was sure I was on my career to being a stand-up comic. And at that point, I got a chance to give my lecture. And I explained to people how the internet had facilitated the transactions and how it would be impossible to handle all the paperwork that was associated with these things without the ability of the internet to do it, and how it had created this competitive fervor around these transactions, and so people mindlessly engaged in them. And after talking for just a few seconds, head started to nod, and at the end of the day, somebody came up to me and said, "You know, I was involved in a $70 million transaction that closed in an instant in all the fervor of the internet." And I thought, well, boy, I've made my point. But then I began to wonder why people were unconscious or less conscious of the role that the internet was playing in this environment. And I thought about it, and I decided that's obvious. The internet was carrying invisible freight, information. And we couldn't see it, we couldn't touch it, and it had become so much a part of our lives that we had essentially ignored it. I thought back and I wondered, suppose it had been 1907 and I had been in Chicago and I had said that another great, powerful interconnection device, one that wasn't nearly as powerful as the internet, had caused the real estate boom in Chicago. And people would have seen the suburbs growing along the train tracks, and they would have seen the high rises rising in the city, and everybody would have nodded their heads and probably thought to themselves, that's an absolutely idiotic comment. But in fact, the railroad can teach us a tremendous amount about the internet, because what the railroad did for Chicago, the internet is doing for the world. For example, think about disintermediation, the idea that you can deal directly with an airline and not have to go through the travel agent. You get rid of the intermediary. Well, the railroad did that for the meatpacking industry. Augustus Swift realized that it was extremely inefficient to ship cattle to the East Coast on cattle cars and butcher them back there. There were a number of problems associated with that. Number one, you were shipping the innards of the cattle back across the country and you were paying for the weight, and that had no value. And then the cattle frequently were injured in the process, and that wasn't a good deal. But worst of all, the cattle lost weight on the trains, and they were sold by the pound at the other end of the line. So Swift came up with a great idea. We'll butcher the cattle in Chicago. We'll hang them vertically in these rail cars, and I'll invent refrigerated rail cars, and bingo. The East Coast butchers went the way of the travel agents. Or what about virtual retailers? Well, all you need to create a virtual retailer is a good transportation system, you know, FedEx, UPS, or a railroad, and a high bandwidth interconnection. Well, you just put a thick printed catalog on a railroad car and ship it to the prairies, and you have your high bandwidth interconnection. And that is the reason why Sears and Montgomery Wards grew up in Chicago. Or what about financial innovations? We all know the internet got us in trouble in 2008 because of all the financial innovations that it was a party to. But the railroad was deeply involved in creating the first derivatives. How that happened was that before the railroad, farmers used to bring grain in horse-drawn wagons into Chicago, and that grain was in a burlap bag, and the bag would have a tag on it with the farmer's name, and that bag went into a warehouse. And then when the grain was sold, you ripped the tag off the bag and you paid the farmer. And then the rail transportation took place, and pretty soon there were 100 trains entering and leaving Chicago a day, and the trickle of grain became an absolute torrent. And handling it was a horrible problem, horrible administrative problem. And so people got together, about 25 people, and came up with the idea of the Board of Trade, and they did something that was very clever. They created standardized grains of wheat so you could mix everything that was the same together, and then they could hand the farmer a receipt. And the farmer could sell that receipt to anybody who wanted to take the grain out of the warehouse. It didn't take the farmer very long to learn that he could sell the receipt before he delivered the grain. And that led to commodity futures and the first really major financial innovation of a derivative. And finally, farmers discovered something else that was very important. Telegraph lines ran along the railroad tracks. And because they could get information about what was going on in foreign markets, the farmers were able to figure out where to ship their product. An information interconnection or an information connection in parallel with a physical connection greatly strengthens the physical connection. So that was an important thing as well. So what I'd like to do now is take you through the concept of overconnectivity. There are two kinds of overconnectivity that are of concern to us. The overconnectivity that is going on in our personal lives, the stress when we're constantly getting emails and reacting to them, the fact that we've moved our lives in many cases into virtual space and are forming friends on Facebook and we're constantly sending tweets to people. The issues in that area are psychological, sociological, and neurological, because the internet does affect our brain. There is as well a form of institutional overconnectivity, which I'm going to be talking to you tonight. And that is the way the internet is affecting business, government, our economic institutions, and our social institutions. And that kind of interconnectivity has to deal, and the issues there have to deal with things like regulation and governance and corporate structure. Now, I define overconnectivity as meaning when things have gotten dramatically out of step. So here's what happens. If I increase the number of interconnections and I strengthen them dramatically, I change your environment, because your environment is made up of the things that you're connected to. So if I make that transition and I strengthen them abruptly, you go through abrupt environmental change, and you're maladapted to that change. So that's one form of overconnectivity that takes place. Think of the newspapers. They were adjusted to a physical environment where you delivered the papers to newsstands and you delivered the papers to people's homes, and suddenly the environment was transformed into a virtual environment, and they were maladapted for that environment. There's a second thing that happens. When I strengthen interconnections and I increase their number, I get a lot more positive feedback in the system. And I don't mean that the way I mean it when I talk to my dog and I tell him, good dog, and he wags his tail. I'm using the term positive feedback in the sense that engineers use that term. And all of you have experienced positive feedback, where change adds to change and makes change progress much faster. If you happen to have a savings account when you were a kid and were being paid 2% interest by the bank, the interest was getting fed back into your savings account, deposited, and you got interest on the interest. That was the positive feedback function, and your account grew, and in a mere 36 years, you doubled your money. But if you could find somebody who would pay you 5%, the feedback loop was much stronger, and your money doubled in 14 years. Well, that's what the internet is doing. It's adding to the positive feedback in society, and it's causing change to happen at a much faster rate. Now, positive feedback in the right amount is an absolutely great thing. Positive feedback was involved in the creation of Silicon Valley. When our economy goes in a funk, the Federal Reserve lowers the interest rates in an attempt to get a positive feedback process going and get economic growth going. So positive feedback in the right amount is something that is absolutely wonderful. If you have too much positive feedback, it is associated with contagions and accidents and driving things to extreme. If that sounds like the 2008 financial crisis, it should. So now I'd like to take you back to the flash crash and showed you what happened there. In this case, what was going on was the environment was remaining static, but the institutions were changing at a very fast rate, and they outran the environment. So if we were to look at the New York Stock Exchange in 2005, we would have found that on the listed securities on the New York Stock Exchange, 80% of the trades were being conducted on the New York Stock Exchange. And the New York Stock Exchange had all kinds of mechanisms in place to make that a reasonably well-behaved market. It had market makers who, you know, kind of facilitated the trades and took in a little extra inventory when there was too much. And it had something called circuit breakers, where if the price of the stock fell precipitously, the circuit breakers stopped the market, and it enabled the liquidity to be replenished. Well, with the birth of the Internet, it became possible to set up something that people have referred to as alternative trading systems. Those are electronic exchanges that people could set up to trade stocks. And between 2005 and 2010, the volume traded in the listed stocks, the market share of the New York Stock Exchange, dropped from about 80% to 25%. So now, all those nice mechanisms and the market makers were no longer involved. Then a second thing happened. Along came high-frequency trading. This is a system where we're using computers to trade stocks instead of people. And more importantly, we put those basically on the exchange floor so they get the information very, very early on. And it's a wonderful system if you think about it, because it's the ultimate in insider trading. They get to take a peek at the market before everybody else does. The volume, and this has become so profitable, that now about two-thirds of the stocks that are traded are now traded by high-frequency systems. So now along comes May 6th. Everybody's a little bit edgy. Greece has got a debt crisis going. People are extremely worried about the debt crisis. Maybe an electronic system malfunctions. The thing we think that was the real trigger was a $4 billion short sale by a hedge fund, Waddell Reed from Overland, Kansas. They sold $4 billion worth of S&P or E-mini S&P 500 futures. And that, whatever happened, pandemonium resulted. Procter & Gamble was trading at $62 a share. Buyers began vanishing in the market. The price of Procter & Gamble dropped to $56 a share. It hit the circuit breaker. It didn't matter to the electronic systems. They found alternative trading systems that didn't have circuit breakers. Suddenly, Procter & Gamble was trading at $40 a share. The good news is by the end of the day, it was trading back at $60 a share. Now, maybe you were an unlucky person who owned Accenture stock and you decided you would sell that. Well, nobody wanted to buy it. But the electronic exchanges had one rule. They had to have stub quotes. And those stub quotes were a penny a share. So some Accenture stock traded at 1 cent a share before it popped back up to $39 a share. Now, those trades ultimately got reversed. Or possibly you were trying to buy Apple stock. Somebody stepped in and was trying to buy 5,000 shares of Apple stock at that time and I think got through about 4,500 shares of the transaction, and he hit the stub quote the other day, going the other way, and was sold shares at $100,000 a share. That also got reversed. So here you have something where the environment remains static, but the institutions underwent very, very rapid change, and people were unable to keep up. One of the things that I argue in the book is that it is impossible to build systems that are this large, this complex, and this tightly connected and make them safe. So that's one of the issues that we have to be concerned about. Now, along comes the crash in 2008. And we all know what caused the crash in 2008. We had too much cheap money. People rushed into the market, bought homes. The price of homes went up. That made it look like it was a really great asset to loan money on. More money flooded into the market. More purchasers raced around and bought homes, and the price of homes kept going up. That was the big positive feedback loop. But that positive feedback loop was supported by 100 or 1,000 small positive feedback loops, all of which were feeding the process. For example, where did the cheap money come from? Well, some of it was a result of the Asian savings glut. And how did the savings all end up in Asia? Well, we moved a lot of jobs to Asia, and the Chinese were great savers, and they needed some place to put the money. But what facilitated that process? The internet gave companies very, very good control over their supply chain. You could find out what was going on in that remote factory. You could find out where your shipment was. And it was almost as good having a factory in China as it was having one in the United States. Or what effect did the internet have on real estate appraisals? Well, I got a lesson in that. I was riding in Los Angeles in a cab shortly after the crisis, and I started talking to the cab driver, and I said, "What did you do before you started driving a cab?" And he said, "Well, I was a real estate appraiser." And I said, "Well, why did you leave the business?" He said, "I didn't like the business. A home would be sold. The realtor who sold it would get on the internet and say, all right, who wants to bid on doing the appraisal? And if I said it's worth $300,000 and somebody else said it was worth $325,000, that guy got the job. And then all you had to do was check the comparable prices in the neighborhood, look at a virtual tour on the internet, and bingo, you had your appraisal. The internet played a role in getting high appraisals. Or what about the egregious compensation positive feedback loop? Well, if I'm sitting in Wall Street and I can tap into surveys and I can read about my friends who are drinking expensive bottles of wine in the Hamptons and I can't afford to buy that bottle of wine, I go to my boss and I say, you know, I'm as productive as the guy down the hall, and I want to tell you that he's making a lot more money. I know he is, because I found out about that on the internet. And so your boss says, you know, you're a great guy. I want to keep you here. I'll pay you more, but you've just got to be a little bit more productive. And so suddenly the pressure goes on that guy to produce more CDOs that are made up of more subprime loans, and so you get a positive feedback loop going. Or what about the credit card positive feedback loop? If I can find out that you bought a new home, I know you need new home furnishings. And I can do a lot of research and find out about a lot of that on the internet. And then I can just target you for a new credit card and hope that you're going to run up a lot of debt. I could go on and on about these loops. But they're all there, and they're all accelerating the process and feeding the process. I'd like to give you a little bit of a different perspective on your loss of privacy. The villain there is positive feedback, too much positive feedback as well. It's about the economics of data agglomeration. Great words. What I mean is, if I know your name, it's not really very valuable. But if I know your name and your address and your telephone number, each little bit of data becomes more valuable. That's a positive feedback process going on. And then if I can find out your Social Security number, what credit cards you hold and what those numbers are, and on top of that, what you're interested in buying, now I've got something that is extremely valuable. And when I have a lot of that valuable data about you, I can go out and call on customers who want to buy that data, and I can get more and more customers to pay me more and more money for that data. And with that money that they pay me, I can go out and buy more data. And ultimately, you end up with a company like ChoicePoint that has about a 400-page book of data on any qualified consumer. Now, there was something else that used to happen. Before the internet, I used to buy those mailing lists, and they would come to me on computer printouts, and they came from different physical locations. So if I wanted to steal that much data about you, I might have to go to 50 or 100 different places and take out my gun and steal the data. But suddenly, we put it all on one place on the internet. Well, that would be one thing. All ChoicePoint or their similar companies would have to do was to make that site very secure. But suddenly, ChoicePoint has 50,000 customers. And pieces of that data get sold to all those customers. And so now, it's not only ChoicePoint that has to be secure, but it's 50,000 of their customers that have to have secure systems in place. And then we put that data out on the internet. And of course, whereas before it was sort of one man, one theft, we end up with 10,000 or 100,000 people that are interested in stealing your data. So we end up with a situation of roughly having a bank vault with 50,000 doors. We don't design those things anymore. You can question why we should put all of this data in one place. And as a matter of fact, if you're the federal government, the 1974 Privacy Act prohibits the federal government from doing this. And I suspect the reason they're just delighted to have ChoicePoint doing it is because they'd love to have access to this data all collated in one place. We are told that data is extremely useful to us because it helps us that people find products that they can sell us that we're going to be interested in. For example, you can buy a list of 3.3 million suffering seniors. No, it's 4.7 million suffering seniors. It's 3.3 million elderly opportunity seekers and another 500,000 gamblers. So one has to question whether making interconnections is always a sensible thing to do. And one of the things I argue in the book is that there are some interconnections that should never be made. And that is one of the things that we have to think about. Well, maybe no talk like this would be right if at this time I didn't mention WikiLeaks. And WikiLeaks is really interesting because what the internet has done is it's created an asymmetry where it has empowered the individual to do things that 1,000 well-trained Soviet spies could never do. Now, what happened with WikiLeaks is that there is a network in the government, and I call it SIPRNet, the Secret Internet Protocol Router Network. And as a result of 2000, the 9/11, the government wanted more data shared, and so they cleared more and more carefully screened persons to be on this network. And I've seen numbers of all the way from 500,000 to 3 million people have access to this network, and all of them are going to keep a secret. And we think that Private Bradley Manning was the person who stole this data. And the procedures around this data were pretty good. But here's a case where the procedures did not keep up with the change. For example, if you're logged in on SIPRNet, you can't leave your desk and stay logged in. There are all kinds of procedures to make sure that you can't carry a removable device outside. But you can bring a Lady Gaga CD out. And so what we think Private Manning did was he brought in something that looked like a Lady Gaga CD, but it was actually a writable CD. He plugged the earbuds into his ears. He sat there and mouthed the words to the songs while he calmly copied 250,000 files and walked out and gave them to WikiLeaks. So this is another case where the process has not kept up with changes in the environment. Well, what should we do about all of this? The point of my book is that we've got to treat the internet with a great deal more respect. And we've got to think about where it is going and where it is going to take us before we just mindlessly do things. So there are three general categories of things we could think about doing. The first of them is to reduce the amount of positive feedback in the system. And if you look at the current Dodd-Frank financial regulations in Washington, they're aimed at reducing the amount of positive feedback. I happen to think they're very poorly designed, but that's my own opinion. And the reason is that because they're trying to tinker with an incredibly complex system, and the only way you're going to make that complex system safe is to make it a lot smaller. And so there are other things that one could do, like you could consider taxation. A few hundredths of a cent of taxation per dollar of transaction on high-frequency traders would dramatically reduce the amount of high-frequency trading. Now, probably if 10% of the volume on the exchanges was high-frequency trading, it would be a good thing. But to let that grow to 60 or 70 or 80% is not. It creates an unstable environment. So the only way I know personally to make these things safe is to make them smaller. So we consider regulation and taxes or all kinds of things that you might do to attack the positive feedback loop. Transparency. Whenever anybody talks about the internet, they say make things more transparent. And hopefully that reduces the amount of positive feedback in the system. The second thing that we can consider doing is realizing that frequently when the internet is involved, we get to where we're going before we even leave. And as a result, we've got to give a great deal more forethought to what is going on before we do certain things. I've thought about this, and I've thought that if I were an engineer at Boeing, and I said to my management and the public at large, I've engineered this wonderful 787, and we know it flies, and we're going to start flying 100 of them around, and after the first 10 crash, we're going to figure out what safety mechanisms we put in place. There would have been an outcry that all of us could have heard around the world. And yet, we let all kinds of financial innovations be released in the market, and we say we are going to fix the problems after we have a few catastrophes. And that, to me, just doesn't add up. And I realize that it's always very dangerous to do something in anticipation of something that may never happen. But I think we're going to have to do a lot more of that. And some of the things are probably fairly obvious. I can remember when we first started talking about email, and it had to be free. And I was thinking to myself, telephone conversations aren't free. Sending letters aren't free. Why does email have to be free? And as a result of having free email, we are all spending hours on spam. And as a matter of fact, computer viruses are easier to start because you can start them so cheaply. And as a result of not having thought through the fact that charging for email might be a good thing to do, we now are spending a lot of time dealing with the problems. The third thing to realize is that incremental changes to existing institutions are not going to fix the problem. The environment has changed, and the institutions have to be radically transformed. So making an incremental change to the New York Times is not going to make it a successful newspaper. And this is especially true of government and governance systems. For example, for a long time, we had national problems and national governments, and we had local problems and local governments. And now, suddenly, we're trying to deal with an international financial system. And if I can't have international financial regulation, the things I do in the United States are going to go on somewhere else and cause the same problems. So we have to begin wrapping our minds around what does this mean for governance and regulatory agencies and things like this, and realize that we are going to have to restructure them in a dramatic way. Well, a couple of years ago, I happened to pick up the novel Flatland. It's a satirical Victorian novel written by Edward Abbott. And the main character in the novel is a wonderful square, and he's living happily in two-dimensional space, and somehow he gets transported to three-dimensional space. And he just finds out how wonderful it is to have this third dimension, and he returns to Flatland, and he starts preaching his message about the fact that another dimension exists and that people should take advantage of it. Of course, he is arrested, and then he's brought before the high priests of Flatland. And the high priests put him in prison for a long time. And I've often thought about the internet and worried about the high priests in our society, the regulators, the businessmen, the people who are involved in governance. And I've often thought that they do not appreciate that the internet has added another dimension to our lives, and that it is extremely important to appreciate that dimension, because if we appreciate it, we can restructure things and do things so we get the positive benefits of the internet. If we treat the world as if it is a flat land, the way it has always been, we are going to experience more really bad days at the office, and that's something I'd like to avoid. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. Bill David Au has certainly given us an engaging and thought-provoking talk, and I think, judged by the number of questions that we have from the audience, there'll be a great deal of interest. As the author of this new book, Overconnected, The Promise and Threat of the Internet, Bill's objective, as he said, was to provoke more discussion about the issues that we face. So I'm going to begin with a question that I had the lack of temerity to compose myself, Bill, and then we'll move on to the audience questions. In your book, you talk about, and in your talk tonight, you talk about regulation and the need for it to try and inhibit some of the overconnectedness that we're likely to experience. And one of the thoughts that occurs to me is that we have, over time, experienced overconnectedness in very different ways in our history. And in particular, a act was put together by Congress called the Glass-Steagall Act in the 1930s, which separated investment banks from deposit banks. And the objective was to make sure that there would be more stability in the banking economy. Roughly 65 years later, the Glass-Steagall Acts were overturned and taken away. And it seems to be part of a tradition that's going on that really doesn't like regulation. What do you think about all that?
Well, I don't like regulation either. And I think I will argue vociferously to make a case against it. On the other hand, I don't know how we are going to deal with these situations without it. And I'd like to give you an example. The notional value of over-the-counter derivatives that existed in the year 2000 was $60 trillion. And people said, don't worry about it. It's making the market more efficient. It's enabling us to diversify risk. It's great. It turns out that I didn't believe those arguments then, and I don't believe them now. But by 2007, we were busy diversifying risk. We were busy making the markets more efficient. And there were $600 trillion worth of notional value there. Now, $600 trillion is 10 times the output of the world economy, the annual output of the world economy. So you say, gee, do we really need all of these things there? And somebody asked me a little while ago, how much of that $600 trillion, do you think, is associated with people just making bets and earning fees? And my guess is that probably on the order of $550 trillion of it is. Now, it turns out that when people were doing those things and they were making those arguments, they never came up to you and said, but we've got something else to tell you. We're going to make the system more efficient, but there's a 10% chance we're going to experience an economic meltdown in 2008. Now, how many of us would have voted to let the world run wild if somebody had told us that fact? And the answer is that so many of these things can race out of control that I think that we are going to have to face up to some form of regulation on them. And I believe the regulation has to be adaptive, and this really frightens me. But I mentioned earlier that I thought that it would be good to have a transaction tax on stock trades. And I think that would be a wonderful thing to do. And so I want to slow down the amount of high-frequency trading. The system can never be made safe. And every article I read about high-frequency trading, people say the whole thing has probably gotten out of control, and we know there are going to be more problems. And so what I would like to do is give the regulator the authority to try a 1/100 cent tax. And if the amount of high-frequency trading continues to grow, raise it to 2/100 cent tax. And if it continues to grow, raise it a little bit more. And if the amount goes to zero, lower the tax a little. Now, that to me is a scary amount of problems to give a regulator. But I also look at the consequences of the high-frequency trading, where we've undermined the confidence of the investor in the market. And so I'm coming down to the fact that I'm much more inclined to want to take regulatory risk than I would have been a few years ago.
The next question comes from a member of the audience, and it's phrased as follows. As one of the early Silicon Valley venture capitalists, did you foresee our society becoming overconnected?
All right. No. And as a matter of fact, I started working on this book a long time ago because I saw what was happening and I couldn't figure out why. And I read a lot of wonderful books that people had written, and they had a lot of data in them. And whether it was Francis Carencross's The Death of Distance or some of the things that Tom Friedman wrote or a number of other very insightful authors. But I was trying to understand what the fundamental process was that was going on. And after I'd been working on this for about 5 years, it suddenly dawned on me that all we were doing was adding a little bit more positive feedback to the system. And once that light went on, there's all kinds of literature about positive feedback and complex systems, and you can read it, and there's a vast treasure trove of things. And it's mostly written about sort of different areas, but it all applies, and it's all so obvious. And so I was surprised by overconnectivity as I was as surprised as anybody.
The next question asks whether, if you consider the consequences of being overconnected, do you personally still think that the positives of technology still outweigh the negatives?
I absolutely think the positives of technology outweigh the negatives, but I absolutely believe that it has to be managed. And it has to be managed by us as individuals, and it has to be managed by us at an institutional level. Because just because you can do things, just because I can acquire a 400-page book on you and sell it, doesn't mean that it's something that is socially beneficial.
The next question talks about the fears of the loss of privacy and the kind of unethical practices that occur sometimes on the internet, false information, and the danger of sort of electromagnetic fields from our electronic devices, sort of all the negatives one can think of. The question is, what can we do about this?
I think it's going to be very hard to deal with these problems. But, you know, and I don't know specifically what we can do about them. I suspect we can chip away at them. And, you know, there are lots of things that we as individuals can do about them. I try to give up very little information on the internet. And I want to say the internet service that enables you to report where you are in the world at any individual time, is it Foursquare or something like this? I would never do that. And so I think a lot of it is consumers rejecting these things, but as long as we like to play with the gang, it's going to be very hard to gain control of it.
The next question from the audience asks, how is the concept of net neutrality related to the issue of overconnectedness?
Well, I didn't used to have as strong an opinion on net neutrality as I do now, but I now know how to solve the problem. Net neutrality is basically that nobody gets to discriminate against the amount of data that they're pouring onto the internet and it sort of is a way of taking the common carriers and making them carry massive amounts of data people can exploit that, because if I get to constantly download movies for nothing and somebody's trying to get a simple email through, and one of the reasons why I can constantly download all of that is because of network neutrality. And I think that we have not figured out how to structure the common carriers properly. And I would think it's time to own up to the fact that Comcast is a common carrier, the cable companies are a common carrier, and tell them they can't own content, and let them sell their services like the telephone company used to.
Well, that in fact leads to a second question that was asked in this area, and that is, what's your opinion about the decision today that Comcast will be allowed by the FCC to purchase NBC?
And I would say that, it's in my opinion, it's a bad idea. And the reason for that is that, once again, it's going to become a nightmare to regulate it and ensure fairness. And I was in business. I know how you take advantage of situations like that. And people are just going to do it.
Back to yet another relatively current event. The question is, they would like you to comment on the use of technologies like Twitter and Facebook in the current situation in Tunisia. Is that good connectivity or not?
Well, I'm not quite sure about how Twitter and Facebook were being used in Tunisia, but there are examples of, for example, one of the coups in the Philippines was texting played a very important role of that. And I am told that, in the fall of the Berlin Wall and lots of the unwinding of the Soviet economies happened because of faxes. So these things are ways of mobilizing social movements. And I think in general they're probably good things.
So So this one is a test on how strong your biology background is. The questioner says, the human brain is highly interconnected and seems to work pretty well, but it has both positive and negative interconnections. And the question is there a way to introduce negative interconnections in the internet over connectivity?
Is there a way to introduce negative interconnections? I think there's a way to damp out the things. I mean, like charging for email. And I'm not sure how to talk about the negative interconnections.
That's fair enough, and that's why I gave you the out at the beginning. It might be a more difficult thing to deal with. So we have another question, and it was motivated by a speaker, David Brooks, who was here approximately a week ago. And what he said was that there is some likelihood that the way things are going in sort of the current management of our economy, that we might find ourselves to be sort of an Argentina in less than a decade. Mm-hmm. And so that motivates the question of what's the likelihood that there will be more instances of the Iceland meltdown, and will the United States be likely to experience such a collapse?
Well, I've looked, or at one point I looked a lot at Iceland because it was, I mean, at Argentina because it was a pretty interesting connection. The connection they made was they pegged the peso to the dollar. Bad idea. And one of the things you do is when you connect something that is stable to something that is unstable, you can make both things stable or both things unstable. In the case of Iceland, it was a different kind of connectivity, and we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what happened to Iceland. And not all interconnectivity has to be the internet. What Iceland did was it gained access to the European market. It joined the European Economic Community. Now, here you had an economy that was around $20 billion. And suddenly over here, you have a multi-trillion dollar economy. And Iceland could tap in to the savings of a multi-trillion dollar economy. Beautiful case of setting up over-connectivity. So the Iceland banks were all reasonably small, but suddenly they figured out how to gain access to those assets. And so the Iceland banks ended up with assets of around $100 billion, or around five times the gross national product. That would be some of those banks ended up with assets. They had to. There were three big ones of a third of $30 billion. It would be 1.5 times the gross national product of Iceland. That's one thing that happened. Now along comes the internet, and the internet does something really interesting. The Iceland banks had at one point in time, I'm going to get this all wrong, but they had a deposit. Anyhow, they had massive amounts of deposits in proportion to their assets. Good thing. And that means that you can loan money and you it's very hard to have a run on the bank. And then what happened was they started taking in all of these securities, and they didn't have enough deposits to stop the loan on the bank and the run on the bank. So they got a great idea. We are going to set up internet banks. And they started draining assets out of the UK. And so pretty soon these banks are accumulating massive amounts of assets from the UK. And the only restriction that they had to have in place was they only had to have deposit insurance in place. Well, the economy of Iceland was too small to ensure the deposits of all of these banks or all the assets that were flowing in. And so what happened is that ultimately the banks couldn't return the money. And the average Iceland citizen, I think, has I'm going to quote the wrong numbers, but has taken on a massive liability, or they tried to impose a massive liability on the average Iceland citizen, and the voters rejected that. What went on in Ireland was different. Ireland had a situation that was similar to Iceland, and what the government did was it guaranteed all the deposits, all the foreign deposits, and so that's created a horrible problem for the government, because now it's guaranteed everything the banks have done. The Iceland government tried to eschew that guarantee, if I have the story right. So there are lots of situations, each one of them different, but that result from people small things becoming connected to big things and then draining assets from them.
In the book, you talk about the sort of contagion opportunity of ideas and thoughts. And the question is, how does this overconnectedness deal with accelerating the fact that the internet is basically unmonitored and unfiltered, whereas historically the news and information has come primarily from very trusted sources?
Well, the internet is dangerous in the sense that we all hang out with people who have the same opinions. And what the internet does is it enables us to create groups that all think the same way, and then we can provide them with a lot of information that may or may not be factual. So if you get extremist groups, they all hang out together and they all start talking with one another, and they can feed on one another, and you can have, the equivalent of a virtual mob phenomena going on there. The other problem is that when we were paying for journalism, we really had great controls in place in a lot of the places that believed in good editorial policy. And there was a tremendous amount of questioning of facts that went on. And that layer of control is gone in the blogs, but it also is a layer of control that is becoming too expensive for a lot of our regular publications to have as we've cut back on things. So I think editorial control played a really important role in monitoring these influences, and there's just less of it.
The next question has to do with the efficiency and the speed of the internet. And the questioner remarks that speeds in places like Europe and Asia typically are much faster than they are in the United States. How much does this contribute to overconnectedness or to the control of overconnectedness?
Well, the faster the internet gets, you know, the more things you can displace and the more things you can do. I talk about something in the book that I call information efficiency. The idea is information equals what it can replace. And so you think about this, and a lot of the things you do physically in this world are associated with gaining information, like going to the store or getting on an airplane and taking a trip to have a face-to-face meeting. And so if you can move information, you may be able to get rid of the face-to-face meeting in New York, and then you can get rid of the airplane, and then you can get rid of, you know, the need for as many airports and things like this. And so the ability to move information changes the fundamental structure of society. And the faster and the better you can move information, the more of those changes you're going to have. Right now, even we're moving information pretty quickly in the United States, and I would think that the effects of moving it faster are going to be incremental, not revolutionary.
Another question has to do with the difference of the effect of overconnectedness as distinguished between the effect on organizations and systems and governments versus the effect on an individual in terms of how being overconnected affects that person.
Well, I've spent a lot of time looking at how tools affected human evolution. For 2.5 million years, we have been evolving in physical space with our tools. And remarkable things happen. If we look at a chimpanzee, its digestive system is 3 times ours. It's 5 times stronger, roughly, and its brain is about 1/3 of our size. Well, fire, which made food more digestible, and stone tools working with our brain, which made us more powerful, enabled us to happen. 25 years ago, we moved into virtual space. And our brains were not designed for that. Now, I know we're all in awe of what 10-year-olds can do. And I liken what 10-year-olds can do to going to the gym and building up my muscles. I can change my physique, or I can strengthen my physique, but I can't change it from an evolutionary point of view. And the real thing that concerns me is that I know our brains would be designed very differently for a virtual environment. And the example I give, which is kind of serendipitous, is that on 3 separate occasions, fish evolved with 2 sets of eyes. The ideal human configuration in a virtual world is 2 sets of ears. 1 set with the earbuds, and another set so we can hear when we're jogging if we're going to get run over from behind. Now, I mean, that is carrying something to an extreme, but we're beginning to understand that we're misusing dopamine reactions, that we're getting cortisol releases. We know things like post-traumatic stress disorder, where people are exposed to stress in the war, cause their hippocampus to shrink. And these are all things that we're using our brains in ways in which they weren't designed to be used. And it's a concern. I don't understand very much about it, and there are a lot of people who are trying to figure out what to do about it.
Well, we're ready now, Bill, for our very last question. And you may choose to answer this however you choose, but the question is, based on all of your understanding of overconnectedness, do you still do online banking?
Yes, I do, and I couldn't live without it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Bill, for an engaging and wonderful program of talking about your book on overconnectivity. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, in which our guest, Bill Davidow, who's a veteran of Silicon Valley, has been discussing what he sees as some of the issues with the interconnectivity that occurs on the Internet. I want to thank him for speaking about his new book, Overconnected, The Promise and Threat of the Internet. And we also want to thank our audiences, both here in the headquarters of the Commonwealth Club, as well as on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Common Club Science and Technology Forum. And I'm Dr. Charles Geschke, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.